Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ethnographic Marginalia, a special series on the New Books Network. I'm Sneha Anavarapu.
And I'm Alex Diamond.
And we are the hosts of this special series.
Ethnographic Marginalia brings together a set of conversations around ethnographic practice. In each episode, we will converse with an ethnographer about their research design, process, and fieldwork experiences.
This special series centers the dilemmas, tribulations, mistakes, and pleasures that go into doing ethnographic research. We hope to use the conversations that transpire on this podcast as an opportunity to build community amongst ethnographers in various disciplines.
Towards this end, we also have a website where we publish field notes, ethnographic essays, photo essays, and methodological reflections.
Please visit our website, Ethnographic Marginalia, at www.ethnomarginalia.com to know more about how you can publish with us. We really look forward to hearing from you.
Before we proceed with this episode, we'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Ethnography Incubator at the University of Chicago and the Lozano Long Institute for Latin American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin.
And on that note, let's begin. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Ethnographic Marginalia. Today, we are in conversation with Tahseen Shams. Tahseen is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Toronto, St. George, and the Bissell Haid Research Fellow at the Center for the Study of the United States of the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. Today, we are going to be discussing the ethnographic research that Tahseen conducted for her new book, Here, There, and Elsewhere, published by Stanford University Press in 2020. The book breaks new ground by showing how immigrants are vectors of globalization who produce and experience the interconnectedness of societies, not only of societies of their origin and destination, but also the societies in places beyond what Tahseen calls elsewheres. Thanks, Tahseen, for taking time out to talk to us today. We feel so privileged to be in conversation with the author of this, you know, fantastic new book amongst us.
Oh, thank you so much. The pleasure is all mine.
So, Tahseen, we often begin with this question for our guests, just as a way of understanding sort of what drew them to the discipline. So how did you become a sociologist and why ethnography in particular?
Thanks for these questions, Alex. I actually begin my courses with this anecdote. So that's a great place to start, I think. So my book and really the beginning of my journey into sociology is very much rooted in my personal story. I am a first generation Bangladeshi immigrant who first arrived in the United States with her family as a teenager. But my first exposure to the United States was in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, a small, predominantly white conservative college town where my parents still live. I did my undergrad there. And that was my first introduction to a society where I was no longer the privileged religious majority or the elite class minority. So suddenly, in the span of one day, I became a marginalized, stigmatized outsider. I spoke differently. I spoke with an accent. I was not Black. I was not white. So often in every situation almost, I was the only one who sounded different, who looked different, who had a different cultural, religious background. As we know from reading Du Bois, that sometimes that positionality of being in the margins gives you a different view of society. And that is what I was going through when I first moved to Mississippi. I fully intended to be a doctor. And I was taking courses to that effect. But then I had to take an Intro to Soch course as part of my required liberal arts curriculum at my undergrad institution. So I took the Intro to Soch class that took place in a huge auditorium where, you know, students are packed elbow to elbow like canned sardines. And the professor started the course with a lecture on the sociological imagination. And as I listened to that, I felt for the first time that, wow, my individual story mattered. I lived in society as much as society lived in me. And I began to ask whether other people in Mississippi who came from similar backgrounds had the same kinds of experiences. I was in honors college, so I had to write a thesis, and I wanted to do a thesis that explored this question. So I started interviewing, whoever I could find through snowballing, who were Bangladeshi, who were Muslim, and that was my first real taste of doing qualitative research. The very small handful of Bangladeshi immigrants I knew in the area through my parents, I started to take an academic interest in the conversations we were having, the experiences that we shared in our tiny little community. And that was also my first taste of doing participant observation. So that was how this began, through a combination of my personal story and an intellectual curiosity. And by the time that I was done with that course, with my junior year, I knew that I found my calling. And I wanted to carry on this line of questioning. I went to UCLA, where it was my dream school because of its strong migration program. And I continued asking these questions, and I continued asking these questions in that way, using those methods. And that's how it all began.
You introduce the methods of the book with a very reflexive reckoning of who you are and how your identity and social position informed your methodological approach to the book. And listening to you talk about how you became a sociologist just kind of reinforced this way of thinking about analysis, about sociological work itself. So could you tell us a little bit about how being Muslim American, as well as being a woman, the intersectional locking of these two embodied and perceived identities, how they shaped your fieldwork?
Well, I'm really glad that you brought up the question of gender for two reasons. First, it was hugely important, a crucial part in shaping my experiences during fieldwork. And I talk about how those experiences shaped some of the findings, some of the observations I was able to make and I was unable to make in my book. And the other reason is that I feel that because of the nature of my book, I wasn't able to fully explore these intersections of my religion, my ethnicity, my class with gender. So thank you for giving me this opportunity. To give just one example, I come from a Muslim background, but I don't wear a hijab or any kind of explicit marker that paints me as Muslim. Unless someone asks what my name is, I could be any other brown person from any other cultural or religious background. But nonetheless, often I was perceived as Muslim American, just from how I looked, and based on my accent. So immediately, I felt after coming to the United States that people are looking at me, perceiving me differently. Before I go into my field work, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, back in Mississippi, when I would walk from one building to another at my undergraduate institution for my classes, I had more than one interactions where evangelical students would stop me and want to convert me to Christianity, knowing that I was Muslim. I have never met these people. I don't know how they came to know of me or what they even saw when they saw me, but they knew somehow that I was Muslim after hearing my name or talking to me, and they wanted to convert me to Christianity. So this sense of otherness that I experienced in the U.S. Gave me a sense of understanding that, okay, I'm an other here. Mm-hmm. Even before I began, I became a sociologist, I had these interactions. This looked a little different among the Muslim American communities, where people took for granted my Muslimness, and I had to project to what extent am I Muslim? To what extent is my religiosity? Mm-hmm. And with that came this question of, well, am I a good Muslim? Meaning, am I like a very pious, practicing religious Muslim? As opposed to, am I not practicing? Am I, you know, agnostic, or am I a bad Muslim? Right? And then, given that I am a woman, it also brought on various gendered preconceptions, like, am I a good Muslim woman? What that meant was, do I live with my family? Am I married? Do I date? If I'm looking for a partner, what kind of partner am I looking at? Interested in non-Bangladeshi or non-Muslim men, and what that meant. Mm-hmm. So immediately, it was from Mississippi when I moved to Los Angeles and conducted research for this book. I was looking at a different dimension of the intersections that I was struggling with in Mississippi. Sometimes being a woman within that Muslim community meant that I had a very narrow entry into the male spaces in the community, especially in the religious communities. That meant very limited access, because most of the public spaces were male-dominated. They were gender-segregated, if not formally, informally, implicitly, which were just as powerful. One time I remember that I wanted to, I went to a cultural, secular space, celebration of some kind on a college campus. And there were lots of students from the Muslim Students Association there. And I thought that this would be a great place to recruit interviewees, and I extended my hand to shake their hands when I introduced myself. I realized that the man did not want to shake my hand, which I couldn't at first understand, like, why? Because these were young, college-going men, so I just took for granted that I would just introduce myself like I do with anyone. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the case. In another, to give another example, far fewer men responded to my recruiting strategies through texts or through emails than women. And sometimes I had to actively ask the women to connect me to their male friends, you know, because I wasn't having a lot of luck just on my own. And I found that my women respondents were a little reluctant to do that themselves. Mm-hmm. What I later realized is that they themselves didn't want to put themselves in a situation where they were beholden to their male friends somehow, mm-hmm. for doing a favor and being interviewed for me. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever I went to some cultural ceremonies or organizations, organizational events, it was informally gender segregated. Even when I went and sat where all the men sat just to hear what they were talking about, I had, I had a very direct experience of someone telling me, go sit with the women. So it clearly, the fact that I was that I was a woman, I was an unmarried young woman living on her own in the context of the Muslim American community, meant that I had a very gendered access into the spaces that I was able to make my observations. Obviously, that in itself reflects contours and cleavages of the communities that I was studying. But while doing field work, that was obviously a source of frustration. Mm-hmm.
I can imagine. It seems really striking, these kinds of examples and the way it's shaped field work. Yeah, it's really come to the fore. Thank you for answering that with so much, you know, honesty and reflexivity.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for asking that question.
Tahsin, I actually thought that your book was really notable in the extent to which you engaged with these questions of reflexivity and positionality and your experiences in the field. You know, I thought that was a real strength of the book and helped the reader understand not only, you know, where the research was coming from, but the communities that you were studying. So I was actually wondering if this was like a conscious choice. Do you think it came out of the fact that you shared a lot of characteristics with the population that you were studying, as a South Asian Muslim immigrant? Why so much, which I thought was amazing, was really a strength of the book, but why so much attention to this in your writing?
Thanks, Alex, for the kind words and for this question. I wanted to tell as honest a story as I could. And by that, I mean honest in doing the best I could to analyze what I observed unfolding on the ground in the immigrants' day-to-day lives. And honest in the sense that I was the tool of measurement. As an ethnographer, I was viewing the world, whatever that the readers would read will be through me. So it wasn't a very conscious choice that I wanted to be very reflexive, or that I had to, I had to reorient my writing somehow to bring in more reflexivity about my positionality. It just came from that that intention to tell as honest a story as I could, and people were responding to me. I was responding back. Sometimes they didn't respond to me, and that itself was a finding. How people responded to me as an insider, when they perceived me to be an insider as opposed to an unfamiliar new face. Those were findings, and there is no other way to convey the nuances and the importance of those findings, the patterns and the differences, without talking about myself, my positionality. Because how people were responding to me is as important a part of the story as what I observed them doing or saying. I think that's how my positionality and my reflexivity entered into the narrative. And the other thing is that, this is something that I had to wrestle with, I had to struggle with when I was conceptualizing the whole project. Because if people are always responding to me, if all my observations and interview responses are reactive to what I am saying, or what I look like, or what I sound like, or what I'm asking them, I wanted something that would balance that out. And that led me to look for organizational documents, not just in Los Angeles and California, but in other places of the country, to look at social media data where I was not present when people responded to something, something that would balance out this interviewer effect. So even when I was writing the book, I went back and forth with my notes to the data that I had collected from the organizational documents and from the social media notes that I had taken as well. To see, well, this is the kind of response that I was getting, and this is the kind of response they were, my participants, the larger Muslim American community, and the national and the global audiences as well, were making on these topics. So I had to go back and forth tell that story, what I was observing and how I was analyzing the data through my point of view, but also what was happening beyond my reach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it so happens with qualitative research that we can take stock of the methods that we used almost after doing fieldwork, right? Because like things are so dynamic and contingent when we're in the field. But I was curious to know, so what ended up being your repertoire of methods, and what did a typical day during fieldwork look like?
No control over a typical day.
Right, yeah.
Sometimes I would have like two or three people respond to me, giving me their time, like blocks of time on one day back to back. And I would have days when I didn't have anyone respond to my requests for interviews. Mm-hmm. Whenever possible, I would myself go to different spaces when I didn't have interviews scheduled to see what was going on. If I could, just sit down at an ethnic restaurant and see what was going on during the week as opposed to a weekend. Mm-hmm. So it was a number of different things that I wanted to incorporate, as long as I felt that every day I did something to make some progress. Mm-hmm. I was happy, even if that meant that I'm going to sit down from 9 till 8, just looking through newspapers in the major national outlets to see, what was the news, what were the topics that generated a lot of attention pertaining to Muslim Americans, or that, okay, I need to sift through all my social media data to see what are, categorize them into different topics. So a typical day in fieldwork sometimes meant I was out there collecting interviews almost all day, Ubering back and forth or taking the bus back and forth. So it meant just collecting two interviews sometimes meant the entire day. Sometimes it meant a relaxing day, relatively speaking, taking notes at, a public hangout space within an enclave or something like that, spending an entire day just talking with my participants, just hanging out with them, seeing what they did, and just taking a passive role and letting them decide what to do with the day, how to hang out. Or just staying at home, working with the notes that I had already collected. So there is no typical day. It depends on, when you're doing field work, at least in my case, I completely had to surrender my schedule to my participants' schedules, right? So yeah, yeah. I had very little control over my day-to-day routine. Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So one thing that you actually just mentioned was your use of social media and Facebook. And you just said that it was sort of a way to get past interviewer bias because, you know, that was not necessarily directed at you. But it also seemed like Facebook and other social media was for your research participants was something that was actually a central part of how they got news, formed and expressed their political opinions. And sort of a central argument of the book has to do with the role of politics elsewhere, such as the Middle East for South Asian immigrants in sort of how they understood their place within the country and the meaning of being a Muslim in the U.S. I don't think I'm doing your argument justice at all, and we recommend that people read the book for the full argument. But I wanted to ask about this use of Facebook. Was this something that you'd planned from the start? Was it something that sort of started happening where you... Did you end up as Facebook friends? This was actually, I do research in a rural community in Colombia and hadn't thought that Facebook would be a force here. And people just started friending me and I started seeing that there were things that came out on their Facebook that were interesting. So was it kind of a happy accident like that, or was this an intentional choice that you made beforehand?
It was absolutely not intentional. I was halfway through my fieldwork when I realized that I need to collect social media data because I would spend the whole day with a group of participants and would feel quite happy thinking like, okay, I think I understand what matters to them the most. I think I have a grasp on their everyday lives, their everyday concerns. And then I would meet with them again the next day, and they would be talking about things that happened yesterday that I have no idea about. And what I realized was that they had a completely separate virtual life where they were interacting with one another. They were talking about gossip, and, you know, it was like an entirely different but very real world. So that's when I realized that, no, I have to systematically collect this data now. But Alex, like you said, that it wasn't intentional. When I started entering my field work, it started very organically that people would befriend me or I would befriend them. Just to initiate a kind of contact, or I would follow somebody on Instagram. It was halfway through my fieldwork when I realized that when I go on Facebook, what I see trending is actually an important source of data. Because again, I am a part of this community. I am trying to embed myself into this community. And what my social network, what my participants and their friends who are not my participants were talking about is valuable data. So that's when I got my, modified my ethics review. I started systematically collecting the social media data. I should add that every social media data that I have collected or talk about in the book has a public setting, or at least when I collected this data. So I was very concerned not to, because of the strategic reason of incorporating the Facebook data, I was in a dilemma that I will not tell them that I am collecting this data, because then I do not have that that balancing out of the interviewer effect. But that meant that I cannot take advantage of anything that they share privately,
right,
among them, or something that I can see that they have shared with only a handful of people. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to take advantage of those things. So the only things that I collected and I discuss are things that they shared publicly, which I think is also an important thing to consider, how Facebook has this pseudo-public, pseudo-private kind of thing going on, mm-hmm. that people can select their level of privacy or their level of engagement. So whatever I selected was something that my participants or their friends, even Facebook celebrities, they wanted out there.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really useful way of thinking about how to incorporate, digital practices of our interlocutors into field work without necessarily letting them know every single time. It retains that organic emergence of their communication online and is still ethical. So thank you for being so clear about exactly how you were able to do this. I'm sure a lot of people who are kind of stuck at home during a pandemic trying to do ethnographies of Facebook or Twitter will appreciate this really clear spelling out of how you did work that for this book. But speaking about presentations, in chapter 4, you so beautifully and very carefully show the several processes and pressures that underlie individual presentations of being, in quotes, a good Muslim, right? And the story you start with is of Anwar, shows how an act like littering is tied to a larger issue of geopolitical and racialized anxieties. And in the chapter, you reveal the frictions that Muslim Americans live with on an everyday basis between being, on the one hand, a model minority, and on the other hand, perceived as threats to national security. What I found particularly interesting is how you point out the fact that ethnographic data complicated the narratives you were seeing emerge in your interview data. And you say that, in quotes, if I had relied on interview responses as my only source of data, I likely would have found their Muslim identity or the stigma attached to it to affect every part of their lives, end quote. While there is obviously a lot in the chapter that you cannot reproduce during a podcast interview, I wanted to invite you to tell us a little bit about the affordances of ethnography, perhaps through the particular case of how the hijab and the burqa were implicated in performances of being moderate Muslims and what that even means.
That's a great question. When I first started doing interviews, especially with people that I was not very familiar with, interview data generated responses that would seem very aloof, as if religion didn't matter at all. So exactly the opposite of what I wrote there, that it would seem that, based on surveys that have been collected previously by other data organizations, I knew that, say XYZ are important for the Muslim American community. But I would ask questions, is X important to you? And this was when I was just testing out the questions, right?
Right.
They'd be like, oh, not really. Mm-hmm. I never thought about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Right? It was mm-hmm. very aloof. It was very detached. But then when I... started making myself more familiar in their spaces, and they got to know me a little bit more besides being the person who interviewed them. I saw that religion is very much important in their everyday lives. The friendships that they make, you know, the kind of food they eat, where they usually hang out, their best friends as opposed to friends that who they were not very close to, they were all shaped by religion. Even college students who would find their college mates happened to, you know, Muslim students tend to dorm with other Muslim students. How did that happen? Well, they it happened because they met each other through the Muslim Students Association, or their parents connected each other because the parents knew each other through the local mosque. So when I started doing participant observation, I saw that, well, what they were saying and how reality is are very different. Religion is very influential in their day-to-day lives, despite their responses in the interviews. On the flip side of things, when I became a familiar figure, I was perceived to be an insider, whatever that means to my respondents. And one strategy was that I would never bring up religion myself to see when religion comes up, or I would never bring up politics explicitly myself, but see when they would bring up politics. But when they did, when I would ask them more in-depth questions, it was a very sweeping answer sometimes, as if religion and politics affected every part of their lives. Mm. That they were stigmatized as Muslims, as racialized bodies in every single aspect of their lives. Again, I would spend the whole day with them, and I would see that's not the case. Mm. There were spaces when these things didn't seem to matter. A far more important topic for them, a concern for them, would be very mundane, generic things like, going to the office on time, deciding what classes to take, what to pack for the children's lunch that day, or, budgeting for the week, figuring out what to make for the rest of the, you know, dinner or lunch for the rest of the week. So it's important, Rogers Brubaker says this as well, that it's important not to take the Muslimness of the respondents as this overwhelming, overarching thing that defines every element of their lives. It's important not to essentialize the Muslimness of the participants just because they happen to come from a Muslim background. Mm-hmm. So participant observation was an important way to see, the similarities and the differences between what the participants said during recorded interviews and what they did when I was not, formally interviewing them. For instance, during the interviews, somebody would say that, they are practicing Muslim. Well, what does that mean? Well, that would mean that they would pray five times a day and they would fast during the Ramadan. But then I would spend the whole day with them and not once would they get up to pray. When it was time to offer prayers. So it was ethnography was very important to see these differences and also come up with an explanation. Why is it that there is a discrepancy between what the respondents were saying and what they were doing? And the way that I explain this in my book is my positionality, my presence there, that when I ask them about their religion, again, going back to something we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, is within the context of the Muslim community, asking about religion sometimes meant performing as a good Muslim, which means, showing a religiosity. Whereas in a public setting, being a good Muslim meant the complete opposite, that you are secular, that you are not really religious, you're not really practicing. So just deconstructing the various meanings, the layers of meanings attached, and how they varied from public to private when studying this good Muslim category, is itself, a really deep ethnographic project, that there are just so many layers and so many interactions that determine these meanings. But on top of that, it's important to trace those local boundary work, local interactions, to what was happening at a global setting. Why is there a pressure to perform as a good Muslim? What does the word good actually mean? Mm-hmm. These are all connected, as I show in my book, to global discourses about Muslims and Islam, not just between the so-called Muslim world and the West, mm-hmm. but also within the Muslim communities themselves. Did I miss anything that you asked in your question?
I guess I was just curious to see how this ties into the current discussions around the hijab and the burqa in France, but how did that play out in your particular ethnography? Like, where were things about, the gendering of good Muslims? How did that come to the fore?
Well, it's such a complex question, because the hijab and the burqa, any kind of veiling, has so many dimensions. Someone who doesn't wear a hijab, a woman who doesn't wear a hijab but identifies as Muslim, and I had participants like this that I talk about in the book too, I believe, they felt that their Muslimness is somehow defined by whether they wear the veil or not. Mm. And that was a source of frustration for them. At the same time, people who did wear some sort of the veil, they felt a different kind of pressure, that the Muslim community is putting them on a pedestal, that they cannot make any mistake,
right?
Because they are seen as, the good Muslim woman who must always live up to that image, right? Mm-hmm. That they're being put on a pedestal. And B, that they were again seen as representatives of Islam, but from the public. There too, they cannot make any mistake. And by mistake, I mean showing for anything less than hyper-positive, right? I remember a participant who doesn't wear the burqa but wears a veil. She conveyed to me an interaction that she had in LA traffic, which itself is very, very frustrating for anybody. Mm-hmm. But she was stuck in traffic. She was wearing the veil, and someone called her Osama, Osama. And I asked her, "What did you do?" She said, "I smiled as widely as I could, and I made sure that he saw me smile. I would not show anger. I would not, perpetuate the stereotype of angry, unfriendly, aggressive Muslim woman." At the same time, women who wore the hijab or burqa felt a pressure to express that they were empowered women who were asserting their agency in wearing the veil. And they had interactions that they conveyed to me where they had to say that, look, it is because I am American that I'm wearing the veil, that I have the agency to choose to wear a veil. The fact that I'm wearing a veil makes me American just like you. It doesn't make me un-American, but it makes me American. And these are interactions that respondents are having on the bus, where people ask them about their veil. Why are you wearing the veil when you are in America? You don't have to wear it here. And then, it puts a kind of burden to these veiled women to wrestle with their identity publicly, right? Mm-hmm. And share that with people around them. At the same time, whether or not one wore the veil meant that in moments of national security crises, that it exposes them to hostility and danger, that it becomes risky. Especially when I was collecting data after the San Bernardino attacks by ISIS sympathizers, there was a lot of tension on the ground, and Facebook posts went out urging hijabi sisters not to wear the veil, you know, wear a cap or something, so as to avoid generating any kind of hostile attention to them. When you mentioned the discourse in France about the veil, my participants were aware of that. It signaled to them a kind of global positioning of Muslims, especially Muslim women, in the margins of society, that they were categorized as an other, that there is no space for Muslims in Western countries. It wasn't anything new to them, but it reiterated to them their collective outsider status.
Thank you for that answer. It's so much to think about.
It does raise a lot to think about, and it's clear from reading the book as well, but from hearing you talk, just what an amazing job you were able to do of getting inside the world and the meanings of these South Asian immigrant women, and how sort of their daily lives were affected by these broader geopolitical forces in places they weren't even from. So thank you for that. To go back to sort of the questions about field work, one thing you mentioned that I found really interesting was that you served as cultural advisor of the Bangladeshi Students Association. So you're really putting the participant in participant observation. So I wanted to know how you thought that participating in this way, and even in what seemed like a leadership role, you know, that they were drawing on your knowledge of Bangladeshi history, for example, how do you think that affected the relationships you were able to form, and also the data that you gathered?
Yeah, well, that was a stroke of luck. I didn't apply or anything. I knew someone in the Bangladeshi community who reached out to me asking if I would be willing to serve in this capacity. And I thought it would be, since I strategically avoided political organizations and wanted to collect data in secular cultural spaces and there see if politics and religion ever comes up, not to sample on the dependent variable. I thought that this would be a great way to enter those kinds of spaces. But I tried as much as possible to take a passive role that only speak up or only contribute when directly asked to give advice on something that, well, we want to do something for February 21st, Ekushe February, and celebrate Bangla as our mother tongue. Well, how should we write a social media post to commemorate this event? Or how should we organize this event? We want to make a PowerPoint presentation to, you know, give an overview of this day to the audience. Would you please make this and partner up with another member, like co-present this presentation. And I would work with them to do something like that. But the goal was to take as much of a passive role and see what they were interested in doing, what their motivations were, to what extent this association engaged with other associations, and why they were closely linked to some associations and not others? What were the organizational tensions or cleavages? So I think that that gave me a lot of access to various news of cultural events that were going on that I could go and participate in as an observer, or just have that insider access to see what are the tensions in organizations to put up a kind of united cultural front. I actually also volunteered as a Bangla language teacher at a weekend Bangla school. And for instance, one tension was, should we open our events with salam, or the Bangla secular word for welcome, which is shagotam, right? So these were very, I thought, very interesting insider data that I was able to collect through organizations. I wouldn't describe my role to as a leadership role. It was kind of, I would say, more like a sometimes consultant, but it enabled me to look at the organizational side of things. When people got together to collectively organize something, what were important to them? How did they understand and define their culture or their religion, their history? And what were the things that they wanted to communicate to people around them, from, you know, people coming from other backgrounds?
Asking more generally about your different sites and different methods, one thing that Alex and I often like to know about from our guests is whether there were any specific instances or interactions or embarrassing moments that you spent sleepless nights over. I ask because
so many.
Yeah. I'm also thinking specifically, you know, of those instances where your interlocutors assessed your own performance as a good Muslim American woman, whatever that means. And I know that as a woman ethnographer in the field, I had several of these interactions where I just ended up leaving the space feeling either guilty or guilty of having performed a different self, or I felt like, you know, was I really being completely 100% honest about my politics, for instance? And yeah, I guess I was wondering if there were a couple of instances that you'd like to share with us, because I know that talking about our vulnerabilities in the field offers a sense of community.
I just think that this question is so, so important, because when, at least for me, when I was struggling with these ethical dilemmas, I felt ashamed. I felt that I could not share this with anyone because that would somehow make my project look bad or make me look bad. But of course, when you're doing ethnography, if you come out of the field feeling squeaky clean, mm-hmm. And not a little dirty, because you're like, oh, was I truly honestly myself, or did I, you know, did I perform another version that is not as authentic, just to mm-hmm. build a bridge, or generate more information and feel a little dishonest and, you know, a little conflicted. If mm-hmm. you're not coming out of the field with these kinds of, struggles, then maybe you haven't been reflexive enough. So yeah. That's something that I can understand in retrospect. But of course, when I was doing this project, there were just so many things. And this is especially, affected me because I consider myself more of an introvert than an extrovert. So it was hard enough for me to put myself out there. Another thing that we often don't talk about when we're doing ethnography is that when you just, you know, when you're not doing ethnography, when you are not in researcher mode and you meet new people, you don't always click with everyone.
Right.
It's totally normal. But when your project hinges on building relationships and building trust and you know, making access into your field sites, you can't afford to not click mm-hmm. with someone. Even if you feel that you're not clicking, you have to put in a lot of effort to make sure you those connections are still alive.
Right.
That you can still continue collecting data. That is not, the, I think, the healthiest approach in terms of mental health for the researcher. And mm-hmm. that is something that I struggled with a lot, that I didn't feel that as a person, I liked what I was seeing or how people perceived me, whether it was as a, you know, as a good Muslim girl who, mm-hmm. who, you know, did everything her parents said. I mean, my parents are very supportive, but, you know, they know everything about it. But right. somehow having that pressure that, oh, how else can I convey to them that I'm a good Muslim girl? Or on the flip side of thing, how else can I convey to my participants that, hey, you know, I'm not always doing what my parents are telling me. I'm actually quite independent. And just going back and forth with these performances of self, obviously didn't sit well with me. I did spend countless sleepless nights thinking about these things. And some relationships have also suffered because when I was done with my field work, I had to, again, struggle with this dilemma that, you know, these people, regardless of how they perceived me or regardless of how as a person these interactions were unpleasant for me, have welcomed me into their lives and have allowed me to ask them questions and gave me an insight into their lives. And for that, I'm so immensely grateful. But then is it fruitful for me as a person? Is it healthy for me as a person to continue these relationships? A few relationships I just had to let go because it was creating a lot of pressure on me and I just could not continue. There was yeah. a level of toxicity that was hard to define, but something that, you know, again, going back to just some people not clicking. I think my biggest regret or my biggest dilemma and struggle has been making these decisions at the end of my field site that I am so immensely grateful to them. And when I'm not in researcher mode, because these relationships seep into, you know, your time when you are not a researcher, when you're just a person, you know, even though I'm so grateful to them, will I continue giving, you know, allowing them into that space of my life? Mm-hmm. And I had to rely on therapy, on my conversations with my family, and just had to let them go. And that is perhaps the thing that makes me, you know, feel the most conflicted. Mm. That's the bit of story that I don't tell in my book, right? That's yeah. a story that's hidden under the rug, but that has been the biggest struggle, I think.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you said all of this because as you were speaking, I just kept going back to my own fieldwork experiences of, again, letting go of some participants because it was getting toxic in this very diffuse manner that I couldn't really define, but also struggling then to kind of incorporate it in the writing and it not really having any place in the final product that was my dissertation, right? And I was thinking of Patricia Richards and Rebecca Hansen's book, Harassed, and how they also talk about how there's no place in academia almost to like have these sorts of discussions, which are so much a part of ethnography and so much of what, especially women and you know, and queer people have to deal with in specific situations where fieldwork can take a very different tone. And yeah, so again, thanks for sharing your experiences with this. I'm sure it's helpful for especially grad students in the field who don't know what to do with this. With these extra feelings, you know, like what seem like excessive, but they're actually constituting fieldwork in everyday. And it's everyday minutiae, yeah.
Well, thank you for allowing this kind of space where we can have such conversations. I wish I had some kind of space like this when I was doing field work. It would have certainly made me feel a little less lonely, I suppose.
Yeah, that's the hope.
To shift gears a little bit, Tahseen, we were really interested in hearing about some of the ethnographic texts that inspired you while you were writing. So there were like books or articles even that were particularly, you know, that you followed as a model or that you really drew on in the writing process.
Okay, so I'm going to be completely honest. When I was doing my field work or when I was just designing this project, my motivation was not to read ethnographies, but to read anything on migration that I loved. So I read widely, not just ethnography, but when it was a moment of finding inspiration, mm-hmm. that I'm stuck, I don't know how to write, or it's, you know, the language isn't coming out well, it looks too forced, I actually went and read novels, mm-hmm. and novels by immigrant writers, immigrant women writers, South Asian writers like Amitabh Ghosh and Jhumpa Lahiri and, you know, Mohsin Hamid, Orhan Pamuk, and looked at how they played with words. How are they telling a story, relaying, you know, the minutia of everyday life in such a way that it's a profound finding about life itself? How are they, you know, what point of view are they taking? How are they using characters to drive their narrative? I think, and I always say this, that novelists make excellent ethnographers because they observe the tiniest emotions, expressions of emotions, and they can link it to larger experiences, human experiences happening. So whenever I felt stuck, I didn't necessarily go back to ethnographies or migration scholarship, but I went back to non-academic writing. And I think that if there is anything, you guys think that my writing is accessible. I'm very glad you think so. But if there is anything that has influenced that the most, it's probably that, trying to emulate writings of a storyteller rather than a researcher.
I mean, it's very validating because that's exactly what I did while writing my dissertation. And that's also what Javier Oyeru, who was the second guest on our podcast, said. So it is very validating because I do think you're so right. It's like paying attention to people who are telling stories that makes us better writers or better ethnographers in every sense. So we would love to end this interview on a high note and would be curious to know what you're working on now. To the extent that we can, of course, work during a pandemic. But yeah, what can we expect to read by you in the near future?
So I have two goals. The first one is to apply the multi-centered relational framework or the elsewhere framework that I offered in my book to other immigrant groups. So I'm working on a paper where I apply the multi-centered relational framework on Irish Americans and look at how Rome was seen as an elsewhere and how that elsewhere place affected how the Irish were treated in America as Catholics. So that's the one paper that I'm looking at. I'm also applying the multi-centered relational framework on Latinx communities and Black Muslim communities. So those are sets of papers that advance the multi-centered relational framework offered in my book. I have very recently been awarded a big grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council here in Canada.
Yay. That's awesome.
to fund what I hope will be my second book project, which is looking at interfaith and interracial dating, friendships, marriages, and divorces. Wow. So in my first book, I centered immigrants in a globalized setting at the intersection of here, there, and elsewhere, the homeland, hostland, and places beyond. Now, what does that look like for immigrants in their day-to-day lives in the most intimate of spaces? And I thought about this a lot. There can't be anything more intimate than, you know, the person you choose to spend the rest of your life with, or the person you welcome into your home as a partner. At the same time, I think marriages and dating also is a lens that reveals to what extent your host society sees you as an equal, that members of that hostland society are also welcoming you into their lives, into their intimate spaces. So I'm looking at interracial and interfaith relationships, and also looking at how they disintegrate, why they disintegrate, so divorces as well, in Canada and the United States, and then looking at how borders and other global forces that I talk about in my first book play into these very intimate spaces of immigrants' lives.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. Thanks for that. And, you know, thanks for taking time out to talk with us today. We had such an enlightening and stimulating conversation. And thank you. And we look forward to reading this new work that looks excellent. And again, congratulations on the big grant.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you so much for creating Ethnographic Marginalia and inviting me to talk about my my fieldwork experiences. I just hope that, Sneha, you mentioned that you too had experiences doing fieldwork where you wrestled with your positionality. I hope that there is a conversation where we get to hear you guys speak about your fieldwork and we get to ask you questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so too. Maybe in the near future. We do have our introductory episode, I believe, did some of that, but not to the extent that that we discussed today about the vulnerabilities of fieldwork and all of that mental, you know, exhaustion that can entail.
I think that's a great idea. And I just wanted to say, Tahsin, that I think this was a really honest and insightful conversation, and I think it will really speak to a lot of field workers and be really useful and inspiring. So we really appreciate you coming on and taking the time. And congratulations on the grant, and congratulations on a wonderful book.
Thank you so much, Alex.